In the Gospel of Luke, chapter 10, Jesus is conducting an orientation and training session for 70 of his growing bunch of disciples. Out of the blue, a lawyer stands up to give Jesus a hard time. The text of the Bible isn't clear if the guy's a new disciple or just a heckler. "Teacher," he says, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus asks, "Well, what's written in the Jewish law? What do you read there?" "You mean you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and love your neighbor as yourself?" "Right, that's it," Jesus replies. "Do that and you will live." Prodding Jesus more, he says, "So who is my neighbor?" Jesus replies with a parable. A Jewish man from Jerusalem was going down the road to Jericho. He fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him, beat him up, and left him for dead in a ditch. Now, by chance, a priest from a temple was going down that same road. He caught sight of the man in the ditch, and then he crossed the road and passed by on the other side. A bit later, a Levite came walking down the road. Levites were assistants in the temple, a fairly high-ranking position. As the Levite approached where the man was lying in the ditch, he saw him and he heard him groaning. Then he passed by on the other side. Later on, a Samaritan came down the road. He came near the man in the ditch and saw him. He was moved at the sight of him and he did not pass by. The Samaritan went to him, cleaned his wounds with oil and wine, and bandaged him up. Then he put him on his own animal to ride, and he took him to an inn, and he took care of him there overnight. The next day, the Samaritan man had to go out, but he gave money to the innkeeper, and he said, "Take care of him. If you spend more than this for him, I will pay you when I get back." "So what do you think?" Jesus asks his questioner. "Which of these three travelers was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" The man replies, "The one who showed mercy to him." Jesus nods and says, "Yes, now go and do likewise." In this fall season at UUSS, our Sunday service theme has been heritage and legacy. Though the Unitarian Universalist movement and this UU congregation have become amazingly diverse in terms of religious and philosophical beliefs and spiritual practices, our heritage has roots in Christianity. In the 1700s and 1800s in this country, both Universalism and Unitarianism were heretical movements in the Christian tradition. Using their God-given ability to reason, using their heart and their personal experience, our Universalist and Unitarian ancestors took the Holy Bible seriously, but not always literally. They took seriously the stories, poetry, and ethical challenges of the Jewish and Christian scriptures. They read and wrestled with the parables of Jesus and wrestled with the stories about him in the Bible. I've been wrestling with a parable, but even more, I've been wrestling with what it means to be a citizen of the United States right now and what it means that so many U.S. Americans identify as Christian. Since the resurgence several decades ago of the politically engaged religious right, many evangelical politicians and political evangelicals have called the United States a Christian country. Indeed, for most of this country's history, that's been a dominant label of U.S. American society, a Christian nation. This is ironic indeed. By irony, I mean, do these two words belong together? Christian America. In spite of the religious diversity that has existed here since the beginning, in spite of the non-Orthodox, non-Christian views of some of the American founders, and in spite of the constitutional separation of church and state, this has been called persistently a Christian country. In spite of the lack of agreement among denominations and religious sects about what counts as Christian, it has been called a Christian country. When I think about the ministry of Jesus as recorded in the Gospels, I am struck by examples of the irony of the words Christian America. Here's one irony. A primary theme of the ministry of Jesus was connection and belonging, an expanded sense of community. Yet recent surveys and studies have shown that there is in the United States an epidemic of loneliness. Not an occasional problem like feeling lonely now and then. It is a chronic source of pain for millions of people. It is an enduring identity, feeling isolated, unknown, unconnected. It's too great a problem to be afflicting only those who aren't Christians. It's too widespread. Not having people whom you know and support and get support from, it's an epidemic. Loneliness is an emotional experience, and it's a physical one. It's bad for our health. Electronically, of course, we are more connected than people have ever been. Emotionally, however, studies indicate we feel as isolated as we have ever been. How ironic is this epidemic of loneliness in a Christian country? The most familiar and frequent ritual of Christianity is communion, the ceremony of sharing bread and wine. Communion goes back to the earliest Christian communities, and Christians continue to link it to the Bible's accounts of Jesus. At a meal with others, he blesses the bread and breaks the bread and passes it around. He blesses the wine and shares the cup with others. Known by some as the Holy Eucharist and by others as the Lord's Supper, communion has a variety of symbolic and theological meanings among Christian communities. The original context of this ritual, what lies behind that sacred ceremony, is the tradition of table fellowship. This is the practice of community centered around sharing a meal. Table fellowship means bringing people together. It means sharing space and time together. For Jesus and his disciples, it meant sharing food not only for sustenance and not only for companionship, but also to make a point about human dignity and equality. It was a way to affirm the human equality of everyone around the table, and by extension, to affirm the equality of everyone around the world. One of the scandalous acts of Jesus' ministry had to do with whom he brought to the table and the kind of people at whose table he was willing to sit. This included women to whom he was not related, even women without husbands or fathers to escort them and watch over them. This included people known to be sinners according to the religious and social codes of his day. This included men who worked for the oppressive Roman Empire, like its tax collectors and even Roman soldiers. Jesus dined at the homes of rich people and shared meals out in the open with poor ones. He didn't refuse the hospitality of those who got their wealth and power by filling a slot in the imperial bureaucracy. Of course, once he was in their lavish dining rooms, who knows what he said to make them squirm. Food and the sharing of it come up so often in the stories about Jesus. In the story of the loaves and fishes, Jesus ordered his disciples to take what little fish and bread they had among them and to share it with the thousands of people who came to see him and got hungry as the day wore on. The disciples at first hesitated, but then they found they had more abundance than they had thought. In September, my housemate moved away, and I had an empty bedroom again. After I posted a listing, I got another housemate. Well, three of them. One of them is a young man from the People's Republic of China, doing a postdoctoral research position at the medical center, which is walking distance from my place. And the other two are his wife and their two-month-old baby. When he contacted me, I expressed hesitation. I had my doubts about four of us sharing the same space. But I was willing to have them come over to meet, look at the place, and talk about it. We discussed mutual expectations of sharing space and sharing chores. We talked about our living habits. We concluded that it could work out for the few months that remained for the family to be staying in this country. I described my unusual work hours to them and explained that I was a minister at a congregation. Okay, the dad said. Knowing that they were from the People's Republic, I asked, are you secular? What's that, he said. I mean, not religious of any kind. Yes, that's right, he said. But he went on to say that he was open. He'd lived with people of different faiths. I've had Christian housemates, he said. I noticed that they'd like to have people over to eat. I smiled as I thought of this ancient practice of table fellowship. People taking time together, not only to eat, but really to commune, to build community. Perhaps to build community beyond expectations and beyond familiar habits, perhaps beyond their comfort zones. Extending the welcome, enlarging the circle, setting another place at the table. Noticing who doesn't have a seat or who hasn't been greeted. Perhaps finding someone you don't know and sharing a conversation and a cup of coffee. Of course, you don't have to be Christian to do this. Indeed, that was the point Jesus was making. The point of his ministry was to expand the definition of what it means to belong. One way to do that is to open the table, invite folks to it, and then add a place at the table if needed, and then add another, and then set up another table. You don't have to be Christian to extend and expand the meaning of what it means to be worthy of human contact and human community. Another irony for me about a Christian America is how much cruelty is going on here, committed and allowed especially by people who identify as followers of Christ. Of course, many avowedly Christian leaders of countries and kingdoms over the centuries have perpetrated massive cruelty, even atrocities. What happened to the simple message of Jesus? What happened to his examples of compassion and healing? What happened to his challenge to reach out beyond our habitual assumptions and fears of other people? When he was asked how to gain God's favor, Jesus emphasized the commandments from his Jewish heritage. You must love God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your strength. And you must love your neighbor as yourself. What happened to that? What happened to Christianity, I think, was empire, a movement which began in resistance to the oppression of the Roman Empire and in confrontation of the hypocrisy of religious authorities, got taken over. the movement got co-opted, compromised, corrupted. Here's how I think it happened. After the death of Jesus, his movement grew and expanded into new territories. Though people of all classes and conditions were drawn to the movement, it remained mostly a religion of people on the margins of society. Many of them suffered for their beliefs, but the simple faith of the Jesus followers kept growing. After a few centuries of this growth, the anti-Christian emperor decided, if it can't suppress them any longer, join them. And in the 5th century, Emperor Constantine became Christian, and so did his empire. And from that point forward, the faith became aligned with power structures and powerful people as it spread around the world. Most of the cruelty and domination committed over the centuries in the name of Jesus Christ, most of the damage done in his name was perpetrated by people who lived in empires, including the U.S. American Empire. Empires and superpowers go for the gold. They see no value in humility, meekness, or weakness. Jesus' life was all about humility and weakness. Superpowers ask, who is my enemy? Jesus addressed the question, who is my neighbor? To be sure, all along there have been humble Christians and poor ones, not wielding power other than the power of mercy and compassion. All along there have been faithful people trying to follow Jesus and his teachings. Faithful, ordinary Christians who remember the story of Jesus' humble origins. In Latin America, in Catholicism in particular, they have a Christmas tradition known as Las Posadas. In Mexico, it goes back 4 centuries. It's a religious procession done out of doors. The procession is a reenactment of those perilous days in the life of Jesus and Mary before Mary gives birth to Jesus. In Las Posadas, actors who portray this poor couple walk from house to house, knocking on doors, asking for mercy, looking for a bed where the pregnant mother can give birth in safety. From door to door, they knock and they get the same answer, no. Private homes and public inns show no mercy to this couple. No, they're not from here. No, they don't belong here. No, we don't have any room anyway. We can't spare it. Finally, Joseph and Mary end up in a stable out behind somebody's property, and the baby Jesus is born in the midst of livestock animals. The ceremonial procession of Las Posadas ends in relief and rejoicing, followed, of course, by food. Later in the month of December, this ritual will happen in Mexico and around Latin America and in cities in the U.S. with large Latin American communities. Yet right now, we are facing a real life story like this one. We are watching an ongoing story of poor people seeking safety and asking for mercy. For the past several weeks, thousands of refugees from Honduras and other countries in Central America have been walking north into Mexico and walking on toward Mexico's border with the United States. The idea behind this caravan, as it's called, is that it's safer to travel with others than on your own. When they travel alone or in groups of 2 or 3, migrants are at risk of assault, extortion, and kidnapping. The risk is lowered if you are not alone, if you go with others. They are wise to walk together, and they are desperate. What else would make you leave your home, send your kids away, or take your kids to an unknown fate? What else would make you take the risk of this journey but the fear of death if you stayed home? About these asylum seekers and other migrants, President Donald Trump has asserted, with no evidence, that most of them are criminals. With no evidence, he says that terrorists from the Middle East are trying to sneak through at the U.S. border with Mexico. He neglects the fact that the vetting process for asylum seekers is rigorous in this country. At our congregation, we know the vetting process is rigorous because our refugee support team works with people who make it through the process and end up settled here in this area as our new neighbors. Last week, the U.S. government fired canisters of tear gas at people waiting on the other side of the border to disperse them, to discourage them by traumatizing them. On the news, I saw barefoot people running from the tear gas, women and children in secondhand clothing, running away from the assault of armed agents of a government whose leaders claim to be Christian. This is what I mean by the irony of a Christian America. But maybe a better word than irony is blasphemy. Blasphemy against the dignity and the sacredness of the human being. Blasphemy against the one named Jesus who said, "Blessed are those who show mercy," against the one who showed how blessed are those who know how to be true neighbors. Donald Trump has defended the government's cruelty toward asylum seekers by saying that nobody can get into the United States unless they do it legally. Whether showing ignorance or willful dishonesty, this is wrong and it's cruel. The people coming here are headed for official U.S. entry points with the aim of making legal applications for asylum. Though some of the folks' applications are being received, the process is going slowly, and people keep arriving in great numbers, larger than the usual pattern. And as the people wait for a determination, as they wait for mercy, many are sleeping on the streets of Mexican towns, grateful for food and medical attention provided by volunteers. Provided by people who ask, "Who is my neighbor?" and respond not with arguments, but with action, with food and water, with money, with compassion. Who is my neighbor? This is the question in the parable of the Good Samaritan in the Gospel of Luke. In common usage, the term Good Samaritan refers to a person who helps a stranger, especially a stranger in distress. Yet in the world of Jesus, people from Samaria, the Samaritans, were feared and loathed by the Jewish majority. Samaritans were seen as dangerous, seen as the other. They were nobody you would expect to help you when you're lying in a ditch. And you probably wouldn't expect to help them either. So when Jesus told the story in the presence of 70 disciples, you can be sure that the story blew their minds. In the parable, two religious leaders, high-level people, one after the other, are passing by an injured man and they walk to the other side of the road. Who finally does help out? A Samaritan of all people. You can hear the murmuring in the crowd around Jesus. Is that what he said? Is that his answer to the question, "Who is my neighbor?" Whether we identify as Christian or not, I hope we can appreciate that the ministry of Jesus was a ministry of inclusion. This meant breaking codes of silence and codes of separation among different people. No matter who we think Jesus was, inclusion still means removing barriers between people. His ministry of inclusion meant inviting people to be part of his community, sharing meals and money as if they were family members. Inclusion still means expanding the circle of what family means. His ministry drew people together of different skills and backgrounds. And for his ministry, he recruited workers with solid work histories and those with spotty work histories, because everybody can play a part in making the world more kind and more fair. Inclusion still means playing your part in making the world more kind and more fair. Jesus' ministry meant being present to others no matter how different they seemed from what was familiar, no matter how uncomfortable he felt around them. Inclusion still means expanding our comfort zones. He created community not by segregation, but by inclusion. He expanded the sense of community by breaking ancient rules, ignoring boundaries, crossing borders, and raising the question, is this any way to treat human beings? Who is my neighbor? Whether Christian or not, it remains a good question to ask. When we don't know what to say to confront a relative's hostility or a friend's misinformation about migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, or anyone else, ask them, who is my neighbor? But that's a question for each one of us, too. When we feel discomfort about those who are different, ask, who is my neighbor? When we are feeling impatient with others, who is my neighbor? When angry with irrational people, selfish people, bad drivers, who is my neighbor? This question works whether we're Christian or Jewish or something else. Whatever we think of his divine identity or the lack of it, Jesus is challenging all of us to question our thinking about people who are not like us. He is asking us to pursue understanding of other people and to show respect for their basic humanity. We don't have to practice any particular kind of religion to try to stretch our hearts a bit more than we thought we could. Showing compassion and mercy is not just for Christians. Reaching out to heal the epidemic of loneliness, speaking out against the empire of cruelty, it's not just for Christians. Stretching your comfort zones, showing some patience, and examining your attitudes, it's not just for Christians, and it's no easier for Christians than for anyone else. That was the point Jesus was making. The point of his ministry was to expand the definition of what it means to belong and what it means to be part of the human family. In our own lives and in the life of this congregation and our larger community, in the life of this nation and all nations, may we strive to keep this question before us. Who is my neighbor? Let us keep our hearts open to the question and open to the ever-emerging opportunities to answer it with our intentions, our words, and our actions. So may it be. Blessed be, and amen.